There we go. Sorry. The figure that's on the front is from a paper that was done by a colleague of mine, Luke Oman, and these are the models that participated in the chemistry climate model evaluation exercise, which was this huge effort involving really many, many, many people, and also contributed to this year's WMO assessment, and the embargo on that was just lifted, but that's the assessment of the state of the ozone layer. And I have to start out by saying that when I look at the spread here and the peak in the ozone change from these different models, with all this evaluation, with all this work, with all this data, I find this kind of frustrating that they're as different as they are. And so that's really what the inspiration for this is. It's how are we going to reduce that spread? How are we going to make it better? So basically, the idea here is, well, you know, on the one hand, you'd like to think that we study the atmosphere and measure the atmosphere and learn the atmosphere just so that we can understand things more. And in fact, a lot of proposals that you read say, we're doing this to improve our understanding. And when I read that, I think, ha, who cares whether you understand it or not, really? What we really care about is whether your understanding is going to help us make a better prediction. In so many ways, it's our reason for existing. If the countries didn't care what was going to happen here, I think you'd find many fewer satellites and many fewer people working on atmospheric chemistry and dynamics. So assessment and prediction, this is really important. What's going to happen to ozone as CFCs decrease and as climate changes due to CO2 increase and other greenhouse gases? What will happen to ozone as climate changes? And we have a lot of satellite data that are brought to bear on this picture in many, many ways at this point. And what I'm really going to talk about here, though, is model evaluation. I'm going to give you three, like, vignettes. One is a natural experiment, and that is actually my favorite kind of thing. It's where Mother Nature does something for us that is just so cool that we learn a lot from it. The next is process evaluation, and this is basically the idea behind the chemistry climate model evaluation, that we have to look at the processes and understand how they're represented in the models to be able to understand if they're giving us anything that we could call a credible prediction. And then the last is something that I've been working on, because beyond evaluating the models and just saying, well, this one is right and this one is wrong, what I would like to do is understand why their predictions are different. And if we can understand why they're different, then that's a place from which we can perhaps come to more, like less variance in prediction or a stronger conclusion about prediction, or at least understand our uncertainty in prediction. So this is a picture. It's from the same paper. And this shows the column ozone. It's integrated between 60 South and 60 North, and it's relative to 1980. That's why everything looks the same there in 1980. And this is all these different models. And you see that when the chlorine was going up, everything was going down, and then everything was going up. And you also see there's some data on here. It's satellite data. It's from the merged ozone data set. And you might feel really happy that everything had the same time dependence, but that's really coming from the boundary conditions, so we really can't get too excited about that particular piece of agreement. But when you look at this spread, and when these models say we're going to come back to, quote, normal, which is 1980 was normal. That's what we've defined it to be. Well, my brother's a real lab physicist, not an atmospheric scientist, and he mocks this plot. Really, he does. And 3/4 of my raison d'etre is to get my brother to stop laughing at me. Okay. Okay, so sticking with this plot, two things. One, all these models purport to solve the same equations. I mean, there are differences among them, but the conceptual model behind them all is the same. And that is another reason why it's kind of depressing to see that much difference. The conceptual model is the same. The way that we discretize the equations, the way that we program it, the way we put it in the computer may be different. So we call that the implementation is different. But we've also been saying for many, many years, for a satellite program, if you want to get your country to fund a satellite program, one of the things you tell them is that we need these observations to compare with the models, to do better, to get the physical and photochemical processes that control ozone and that control climate, and that this is going to improve our prediction and decrease our uncertainty in prediction. And I look at this and I have to say, can't we do any better than that? I think we can. Okay, so just to orient you, if you're not really in atmospheric science, and I know a lot of people aren't, this is a schematic of the big processes that are controlling the stratosphere. Down here in the troposphere is where the people are and where the factories are, and where we have volcanoes and various other gases that are released due to industrial activity and things people do, and they move around down here, mixed up, and eventually make it into the stratosphere. Now, and they enter in the tropics. Once they go in the stratosphere, you have this slow overturning circulation where the gases kind of move up and over. We have UV radiation coming in. We have the ozone layer being produced and destroyed constantly by this UV radiation. And we have airplanes that fly and throw out their pollutants as well. And then here at the high latitudes and the poles, it gets very cold in the winter, and you get polar stratospheric clouds and some fairly exotic chemistry that drives polar ozone depletion. So that's basically the schematic of the processes that you need to include in one of these models. Okay, and then we have some data. And this is a picture. It's a beauty shot of Aura, which is the satellite presently dearest to my heart. And Aura was launched in July of 2004, so we're in our extended mission. We've been operating for quite a while. There are four instruments. OMI, the total ozone measuring instrument, also measures some tropospheric gases, but it's continuing that long climate data record of total ozone measurements that was begun with Nimbus 7 TOMS in 1979. But the main data that I'm going to show in this talk is from the microwave limb sounder. I think I skipped one. I didn't. Okay. And then the other data that I'm going to use in this talk uses the ACE-FTS on SciSat. And I took these beautiful pictures off their website. And they measure, it's an occultation instrument, so they don't have global coverage like MLS does, but they measure many more species, and they also have a vertical domain that ends in the upper troposphere, even for species like N2O, which MLS does not. And so that turns out to be a good combination between those two. Okay, so what are the building blocks of an ozone simulation if you wanted to make an assessment simulation? Well, the first thing you would do is you would observe atmospheric constituents in meteorological fields. And people have been doing this for a while. When my career started in the early 1970s, really there was almost no satellite data. And there was sort of a revolution when you started getting LIMS data in the middle 80s. But since then, we've had many successful programs, not just from the US, but from Canada and from some European platforms, Envisat, and we call this a data explosion. There's all the data that you could imagine. I would never feel good giving a talk like this without mentioning the laboratory experiments, because you have to be able to develop a chemical mechanism to talk about what's happening with the ozone layer. And that is more than 150 chemical reactions at this point. And every single reaction requires a physical chemist to make some measurements. And like, first you have to figure out what the reactions are. Then you have to measure reaction rate data. You need to measure cross sections for the photolytic reactions. And so when you look at one of these models, it's a massive effort to even have the input data to put into the model. There's field experiments, aircraft, ground-based measurements, where we identify processes and test photochemical concepts. And then we take all this stuff that we've learned and we develop this global model, and we say it encapsulates our present knowledge of the general circulation and the photochemical processes that control ozone. And that is a tall order. Then we have to figure out how to test that model, and we're going to use it for predictions. So, as I said, I'm going to focus on three examples of model validation and evaluation. Our natural experiment, we're going to look at how the chemistry climate model evaluation worked in the last few years. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about upper stratospheric ozone and how we can look at the response of ozone to temperature change in the present atmosphere to at least understand what's different among the models in the upper atmosphere. Okay, our natural experiment, we call this the blob that refused to die. So what happened was, in the tropics where the air comes in, the long-lived gases are high, and you have wave motions where the tropics interact with middle latitudes. So just exactly at the right time of year in 2005, there was a big wave event, and it just grabbed this big hunk of tropical air, and it pulled it up to high latitudes, and then the circulation changed from winter to summer, and instead of having this wave-driven, wobbly, vortexy, mixy stew that we have in the northern hemisphere in the winter, we turned to near zonal flow. So we pulled this blob out, and then we just brought it, and it just went around the pole. Went around for 5 months. And so this gives us a really great opportunity. We've got the data is from MLS. The simulation is using a chemistry transport model, which means I'm telling it what the meteorology is, and I'm solving a continuity equation for N2O and doing numerical transport on it. But the winds don't interact with my simulation. Hess and Halton had studied events like this in the LIMS data, and they were suggesting that anomalies would persist in the summer circulation. But they weren't looking at anything of this scale. So this is what it looks like. Early in March, here's my blob. This low N2O area is the polar vortex, very low. And here's my blob forming and coming out and looking really organized there in that week in March. And here it is in July, and here it is. You can still see it. You don't see it very well, but you can still see it. And it actually, between this time and this time, it had circled the poles many times. And that gives us a good chance to test our meteorology and see if our meteorology is good. And it also gives us a good chance to test our numerical transport. And I'm going to give you the answer now. We were able, after about five attempts, to credibly simulate this blob. And we're pretty excited about this because it was hard to do. It didn't work the first few times. Curiously enough, if we had paid attention to the things that you know about numerical transport from the beginning, instead of just putting it in the model to see what we would get, we would have gotten to the results a lot faster. Because the blob goes over the pole, and when it goes over the pole, you have some problems with your numerical scheme because of the way latitude and longitude work, and you have the convergence of the meridians up at the pole. And we just didn't have the spatial resolution to resolve our blob, so we were dispersing it. And it took us quite a while to realize we were doing that, and then we just had to increase the spatial resolution, and boom, we had it. So that's the short answer. But we're using a particular transport scheme, a particular meteorological analysis, and we call this a chemistry and transport model. And this is the figure that I think will convince you that we're doing pretty well. It's a Hofmeier diagram. So this is time going along this axis. And this is from the observations from MLS. And this is our simulation. It's called replay because you recompute the meteorology within the CTM. But that's really not a consequence to what we're seeing here. And the red is this high N2O blob. So you can see it forming. And then you can see it starting to go around the pole. And so that's pretty cool. And in our simulation, it forms, and it goes around the pole. you know, it's not a perfect simulation, but it's certainly credible. And even the final mixing happens at about the same time and looks really similar in the observations and the model. My colleague Doug Allen at NRL has a paper on this that's submitted to ACP just recently. So what conclusions can you draw from this kind of experiment that are important for a CCM? Well, it's important that the GS5 meteorology is enough like the atmosphere to make this simulation possible. And if you were to have used an older assimilation system than this one, well, the first effort to do this was an assimilation system in the 2005 timeframe, and it was a complete failure. So they needed improvements to the assimilation system itself before the winds were good enough to make this happen. But it's also telling you that this numerical transport algorithm, which we call upwind biased monotonic and shock capturing, monotonic means no new maxes and mins. Shock capturing means that if you're trying to move a sharp gradient, it will preserve the sharp gradient even as you move along. Upwind means it looks behind you to make sure that it's to help it resolve the front as it's moving forward. And that this numerical transport scheme is what I would call good enough. So it removes the idea that this numerical transport scheme is a catch-all for problems between one model and another. And then just with this little footnote that we should have known to begin with, you want to look at the physical size of something you're trying to transport and make sure that your grid is small enough to resolve that thing. If it's not, you can't do it. You know, like that's your starting point. So we kind of messed up on that. But I also think that it's important to mention, because it's easy to do, the models are big. The people who run them are usually not the people who wrote them. And things can creep into the model that even the designer didn't know was there. And that is actually what was true in this case. The polar cap, as it was implemented, was 3 degrees latitude, which is huge. But when I had given it to the person to program, I had told them 1, and 1 would have been fine. But they thought, for various reasons, which they did not inform me of, they changed it. And then 5 years later, we get nailed by it. So those kinds of things are there in these big models. They're always there waiting to bite you. Okay, now we made a transition after this, in many ways, from this chemistry transport model, where the ozone does not interact, to a chemistry climate model, where everything is computed consistently. So why do you need to do this? Well, ozone at any point depends on the local photochemical processes and transport. And if transport is important, then non-local processes are important also. The ozone photochemical loss is itself temperature dependent, and temperature depends on the heating due to the absorption of UV by ozone and by O2. And the winds depend on the temperature. So the whole system is, every little piece of it is touching all the other little pieces of it. And so if you're going to do a credible prediction of what's going to happen to ozone in a changing climate, you need to be able to think about the whole system together. So then you create this coupled model. And it's called a chemistry climate model. So the winds, the temperature, and ozone are all computed self-consistently. And how do you create such a model? Well, you need 2 things. You need a general circulation model of the atmosphere. Most of these are developed, well, they're all developed. A general circulation model is developed using an ozone climatology for the heating. Okay, so now we're going to remove the use of the ozone climatology for the heating, and we're going to use our self-consistently computed ozone. So we just take that general circulation model, and then we take the pieces of our chemistry transport model. And that's our photochemistry, all of our chemical reactions, and our numerical transport scheme. And we just put them together, and voila, we have a chemistry climate model. It takes about a year. One of the things, these blocks have to work together realistically, and the whole thing has to be computationally tractable on modern machines. I was telling one of the students I was talking to today, when we first started just using the CTM without the interaction with the winds, we tried to integrate 3D chemistry on the machines we had in the 90s. We integrated 6 days per day. Okay, we need to all just think about that for a moment and hold it in our heads. 6 days per day. I'm doing 100-year simulations now. 6 days per day. We would grow old waiting for a really good simulation. This is another caveat here. The individual pieces might work together, but not, might work separately, but not together. And we actually had experience with this, too, where what was thought to be the world's best chemistry, when put with the world's best transport, created completely non-physical solutions with highs and lows in a field that should be constant all over the stratosphere because of an interaction of polar night with the transport scheme. So you really have to pay attention when you put your pieces together that they're doing what you thought they were doing when they weren't together. It's just a caveat. Now, how are we going to test this model? And that's really the thing because, for example, now I've tested my numerical transport with the blob that wouldn't die, but I can't test it in this because I can't create that blob or I can't control creation of that blob. So I have to come up with some other ways to do it. And the CCM, it's like I'm going to produce a year and I'm going to call it like 2000, but the only thing that's 2000 about it is going to be the trace gas boundary conditions and maybe the sea surface temperatures at the ocean. And the rest of it, the meteorology, will have no resemblance to the meteorology that was observed in 2000. So you have to figure out a statistical way of comparing what you're producing from the model with what you're observing. So the strategy behind the CCM VAL is short for CCM, chemistry climate model. Some people call it validation and others call it evaluation. I prefer evaluation because you actually can't fully validate these models, but that's a different conversation. But the strategy behind this CCM-VAL effort, there's two elements. One is to look at interannual variability in observations and to analyze data and to try to find relationships that are always true. Okay, and I'm going to give you an example of one. And the second is to identify a state quantity that is not varying from year to year. So these are things that the model needs to reproduce because they should always be true. So this is just an example of the first one, and there's others, but I think that this one's really pretty. And this was found, there's a theoretical development behind this, and then it's developed just from looking at observations. And what you find out is that in the winter, you have heat flux going from the equator, where it's warmer, towards the colder pole because the atmosphere would like to be one temperature if it had its way. And it doesn't get to do that, but it's constantly trying. So you always have heat flux in the winter going from the equator to the pole. And it's true in both hemispheres. And because of that heat flux, you have wave motions, and you have that overturning circulation, and it varies from one year to the other. And that varying circulation controls how much ozone is transported out and then pushed down and builds up in the winter. So this is just the ratio of the spring average to the fall average. And it's bigger than one, except in the southern hemisphere, but that's a different story. That's because of the ozone hole. It's bigger than one in everywhere in the northern hemisphere, and that's because ozone is building up. And if you calculate what the heat flux is, and you plot this ratio versus the heat flux, And these are all identified by year so that you can see all that variability. And they fall in this nice straight line. So this is a great example of how interannual variability is giving you a relationship that you should see in your model. And then here's the southern hemisphere, and you notice a couple of things. One is a lot of them are less than one. You also see them grouped down here in this low area. Southern hemisphere is far less variable than the northern hemisphere. It is colder, and that's where the ozone hole is. So even though you're trying to build some ozone up, you're also destroying some, and you end up with kind of a lower ratio than in the northern hemisphere, but still on that straight line. So this is the kind of thing you want to see your model produce. Now, example two, which I'm actually going to talk about, is that the mean age for stratosphere is the mean age for stratospheric air. The mean age is the time since, for a parcel, is the time since it crossed the tropical tropopause. In other words, the time when it entered the air. And you normally figure it out by looking at something that's constantly increasing. So even though maybe we wish CO2 weren't constantly increasing, it's really useful because if we measure it in the stratosphere and look at a time series in the troposphere, we can figure out how old that stratospheric air is, because it's lower in the stratosphere than it is there at the tropical tropopause. And it's years. So you think of, it, when you measure it, you know you're not looking at this piece of air came in here 3 years ago and now here it is over here. But when you're looking at it, you know that this piece that you measured is made up of a lot of pieces that have been on different trajectories. And you call that the age spectrum. And this is what an age spectrum looks like. It's a bunch of little elements. You do this with back trajectories, and they have different ages. You get a mean age, each little element. Some of them are, you know, they all have different ages. The ones with young ages have come in the stratosphere and moved straight over. The ones with old ages have gone up and over. It takes a lot longer to do that. We can calculate the age spectrum, but we can't measure it directly. What does mean age look like? In the tropics and the northern hemisphere mid-latitudes, the mean age, this is with altitude, and you can see it starts at the tropical tropopause, and then it goes up to a few years. It takes about 3 years to get above 10 millibars in the tropics. And then this is a picture with latitude. And there's a sharp transition between the tropics and mid-latitudes. This is the mean age at 20 kilometers measured from aircraft data. You can see at high latitudes, you get some pretty old air, greater than 4 years old. Well, what did models look like? Well, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, models looked terrible. They looked just terrible. The data is, range of data is up here. The range of models is this area down here with almost no overlap at all. And this was very upsetting for modelers. And in only 4 years, the mean age for the models looked great. This is really a picture of something that's sociologically important. It was so important that everyone actually reproduced this, that within only 4 years, everyone figured out a way to do it. And so it now is useless pretty much as a diagnostic, but everybody gets it now. But we still have all that divergence, so you have to try and understand why. Well, how can we understand this? Well, one thing that's true is that with the trajectory calculations, you know that the older elements have been to higher altitude. Now you look at your tracers, and something like the chlorofluorocarbons are only destroyed if they go above, say, 10 millibars. So the part of the parcel that came from old age is going to have all of its chlorofluorocarbons destroyed. The part that still has younger age, it's going to all be intact. So if you measure a bunch of long-lived tracers, you can find out about the way different parts of the atmosphere, you find something about the history of different elements and where they've been, how high they've been, how high parts of them have been. So going back to that age spectrum, these ones would have no N2O, and these ones would have N2O close to their tropopause values. So a result of this is that N2O, which is measured by MLS and ACE, is nearly linear related to the mean age in the lower stratosphere. And so this is the climatology between the ACE climatology for N2O and the mean age measurements. And you get this nearly straight line up to a certain age, and then when you get to really old age, the N2O is going to have gone up too high, and much of the N2O is going to be destroyed, and your relationship breaks down. But this is the relationship that should be invariant among models. You can see that this even includes tropical mid-latitude and profiles, and all the air between 60 south and 60 north at 20 millibars, and it all falls in that one line. So we were able to use this kind of relationship to evaluate CCMs. And I'm not going to show you them all. There's 15 of them, and I'm really not into saying this model is good and this model isn't. But this is what a good one looks like, and this is what the others look like. Okay. So even though they all got that mean age of 20 millibars, when we expand the region, which we can do because we have global measurements, and we include altitude, all the latitudes at different altitudes, we are able to tell the models apart. So now if we go back to our original figure in the prediction, you might have wondered about what all these colors meant. The red lines here are the models that all have the same, that all do well on this mean age and N2O evaluation. And all the other models don't. And if you look at the spread in the behavior of the red lines at least kind of all give a very similar result to each other. So what have we really learned here? We've learned something comforting. We've learned that if the models are producing the same sort of transport, they're giving the same sort of result. But we haven't learned everything that we want. We've learned that the diagnostics can tell us whether or not the models are actually representing atmospheric processes, and the models that succeed all get a similar response. So we're calling this a successful diagnostic. But the step we can't take with this is we can't use these diagnostics in any way that we can think of to figure out a framework for explaining the differences. So until we can explain the differences, then we aren't really going to know. We just know that the models that succeed on this diagnostic all behave the same way. But we don't know why the other ones are high or low. And so that's kind of the next step that we're hoping to take. And to look at that a little bit, we're looking at upper stratospheric ozone. Now, why? Because it doesn't really contribute to the column. But the upper stratosphere is where the biggest losses have taken place, and it's also the place where we think we're going to see recovery the first. In other words, where we expect to see, it's the first place that we could tell that ozone loss had leveled off. That was a 2003 paper. And it's where we think we're going to see evidence of ozone increasing as chlorine decreases. But chlorine is going down, but this is a really slow decrease compared to the rate of increase. It's actually 3 times slower. So it's going down at 1/3 the rate it went up. So that could be a problem. This is some ground station data of ozone. This is the anomaly in the column between 35 and 40 from a bunch of different ground stations at different latitudes. And you can see that there's a lot of variability in the data. You can get an idea of some solar effects. And this is smooth data, by the way. And we also put on here this is a published paper by Steinbrech et al. And they put on here the range of models. And this picture of the range of models gives you the idea that the models kind of are producing that sort of variability. But of course they're not. And this is what the models look like when you do a similar thing. And what you can see is that each model has almost no variability. And that whole range is coming from all the models, some of which we can show you are a little wacky in the way that they reproduce other parts of the chemistry. So we would like to do something more concrete than this. This is the ozone at 40 north at 2 millibars, and this is the temperature at 40 north and 2 millibars. And the models are labeled here, but just ignore that. Don't even look at it. All you want to look at is this incredible spread, which is just really amazing given the number of measurements that we have, and this incredible spread in temperature. The same thing, amazing. But the other thing that you can see is that the CO2, the models all kind of move on the same slope, which makes sense because CO2 is what's really controlling the temperature decrease. But the ozone simulations diverge. And what that is telling you is that these models have different sensitivity to ozone and to temperature, because otherwise they would be going along the same parallel lines. So what we have found out by looking at all these models is that if I look at the sensitivity of ozone to temperature, which I just get from looking where in the upper atmosphere, where it's photochemical, if I look at the sensitivity of ozone to temperature, and I plot that as a function of the ozone mixing ratio, and this is just a model result, you can see that there's a pretty good suggestion of a relationship, and also that there's some points that seem to be outliers. So you want to understand that a little better. Basically, this is your everything you needed to know about upper atmospheric ozone loss in one slide. You have your basic reaction where atomic oxygen reacts with ozone to give you O2, and that is very temperature dependent. And you have a chlorine loss process, which takes a whole cycle with ClO reacts with O to give Cl and O2, and then Cl reacts with ozone to give ClO and O2. So the net is the same as the Chapman cycle. The chlorine's not consumed. It's a catalytic cycle. But this cycle is not temperature dependent. So that's basically where your temperature sensitivity is coming from. This is very temperature dependent. This is not temperature dependent. And these are medium temperature dependent. So with those facts in mind, the sensitivity to temperature can only match that derived from observations if you've got the right mixture of loss processes. And it's going to differ if the mixture of loss processes differs. If the mean temperature is too warm, your simulated ozone will be too low, and vice versa. So now what about those outliers? As it turns out, these outliers are all from one model that is missing a reaction, which we found out in a different part of the evaluation. And that missing reaction makes their model give too much importance to chlorine. So as you can see here, it's not sensitive to temperature as much as anyone else. They're kind of on their own line. They're not on everyone else's line. Everyone else's line makes sense with respect to ozone and temperature. Now, do the observations tell us if the sensitivity is realistic? I can derive sensitivity to temperature from MLS ozone, and that's telling me that the temperature sensitivity should be in this range. So for present day, this was showing you how the sensitivity is changing with time, and I'm going to, as ozone goes up, the temperature sensitivity increases. But this is for the present. So some of the models, you can say that their temperature sensitivity is unrealistic. So if you look at the past data, chlorine increased when the CFCs were in use, and it's now decreasing because of the Montreal Protocol and its amendments. Remembering that this is the least temperature-dependent reaction, and this is the most, chlorine increases, ozone goes down, this one becomes less important, this one becomes more important, temperature sensitivity decreases. Chlorine returns to background, temperature sensitivity increases. And that you actually see in all the models. This is the sensitivity of ozone to temperature, and this is time in all these simulations. And you can see that in all of them, the temperature sensitivity is increasing, is becoming more negative. If you take this one step further and you look at this sensitivity in the present and compare it to the simulated change, if you take out our outliers, you can see that these are related to each other. So the models that are more sensitive to temperature are giving you a larger ozone change than the models that are less sensitive to temperature in the present day. And in the present day, our sensitivity should be somewhere in here. So we can really reject a lot of these results, essentially based on a basic physical principle that you take a system, you perturb it, and you watch it go back. So the conclusion from this part, the upper stratospheric ozone conclusion, in all of our simulations, ozone becomes more sensitive to temperature as chlorine decreases. That basically validates our fundamental chemical understanding of what's happening. But the ozone sensitivity to temperature varies among the models, and this shows that the mix of the loss processes in the different models is different, that they are not all doing the same thing. And the larger the sensitivity to temperature for present, the greater the future simulated ozone increase. So I know that's a little bit convoluted, but basically what you're trying to get at is a way to say, is this response correct? And not just to look at the mean state, because if you think back to those pictures where I was showing you what the mean state was and that huge spread in ozone and temperature, none of them, or most of the models, weren't agreeing well with the mean state. And yet, we're using the response from all of them in our prediction. So, just to summarize, from the natural experiment, what we learn is that numerical transport and assimilated fields reproduce an event that led to a large persistent anomaly in the simulation anomaly tracked observations for 5 months. So that gives us confidence in our assimilated wind fields and confidence in our numerical transport. The CCM VAL transport evaluation showed us that at least some of the models reproduce a fundamental relationship that is telling us about the fraction of air that moves to high altitudes versus the fraction that stays in low altitudes, and how the circulation combines to produce the observed distribution of long-lived tracers and mean age. And that for the simulations that do that, they do give you the same, they predict similar future if their transport agrees. It's a big step. Upper stratospheric ozone, when we look at that, we can discern something about the mix of loss processes that control ozone. And the sensitivity varies among simulations, so our predictions are going to vary depending upon what their present-day sensitivity is. In other words, I'm able to explain the variance in prediction at least between 1 and 2 millibars, okay, which is not the column, but it's a start. The challenge is, can we develop approaches based on other diagnostics that follow the same sort of paradigm where we're looking on the response of the simulation to a perturbation rather than focusing on the mean state. And we have some examples with the Antarctic ozone hole, something we haven't tried yet, but there's been an analysis of observations that shows that the year-to-year variability in the ozone hole depends on variability in temperature to first order. And so that is telling us how the models should be responding to temperature change. And we'll see if we can be doing that. Taken together, these three examples show you how when we argue for a satellite platform or when we argue for continued observations, we're being truthful, we do need these observations as the foundation for developing and for evaluating global models. But there's a big step that's left for us to do in terms of the analysis, because we need to be able to take the step to use the process-oriented diagnostics that we've developed and probably develop some new ones so that we can explain why the different models respond differently to the same perturbation and have a prediction that we can have realistic uncertainty attached to that will make it unnecessary to calculate the multi-model mean, which is an approach presently being used. And I would like to thank my colleagues. Aura, and I said, and the many people who stand behind her. Sometime I started calling Aura she, you know, kind of like the Queen Mary. And I decided also SciSat and the many people who stand behind her as well. In fact, I'm fostering a movement whereby all satellites will be she's. Like ships. I have to thank SPARC, that's Stratospheric Processes in their Rolling Climate, who are the sponsors of the CCMVAL project, and again, the many, many, many people who contributed to that project. And we get funding from the NASA from several different programs. And then the work that I've shown here, I've done with colleagues with Doug Allen from NRL, who's led this analysis of the big blob, Susan Strawn, and our other CCMVAL colleagues worked on the transport diagnostics. And my friend and mentor, Rich Stolarski, who's my major collaborator in this diagnostic evaluation of the upper stratospheric chemistry. Thank you.